The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, December 2018, Volume 19, Number 12. And this is the third and final installment of the December issue. It's the Christmas special, Oprah's Favorite Things issue, and Oprah is on the cover as an angel on the top of the Christmas tree. This tree is made of beautifully wrapped Christmas presents in greens and reds and blues and purples with gold trim and big bows, and Oprah wears a red and gold sequin dress. And let's jump right to the special section of the magazine, where if you've missed Michelle Obama lately, you'll be hanging on every word of her revealing conversation with Oprah, centered on Mrs. Obama's fascinating new memoir, which is also the latest Oprah's book club pick. And this is a Hearst special event, Oprah Talks with Michelle Obama. In a revealing interview, the former First Lady and author of the riveting new memoir, Becoming, opens up about her least favorite question, hashtag relationship goals, life after the White House, and the truth she can finally say out loud. And there's a picture of Oprah and Michelle Obama sitting into blue suede chairs in front of an audience of young girls. If you'd been walking past the Hearst Tower in New York City on the morning of September 6th, I think you might have felt the building pulsating, Oprah says. About 200 people, Hearst magazine editors and execs, and some very pumped-up high school girls were waiting, many literally on the edge of their seats, for my special guest to arrive. And all of these people had been sworn to secrecy, not just about what this special guest might say during our conversation, but about the fact that there even was a conversation, that my guest was even there. Absolute, total secrecy. From a room full of professional communicators and high school girls. Like I said, pulsating. And who could blame them? Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama doesn't do a lot of interviews, and this was her very first time talking about her new memoir, Becoming. It is a remarkable book, so good that I've made it my new Oprah's Book Club pick. I urge you to read it. Because I've known Mrs. Obama for 14 years, and I can tell you, she is everything you think she is, and then some. She served as our country's first lady with such dignity, such grace, such style. Yet at the same time, she really is just like all of us. I'm excited for you to see that about her, and to get to know her, and to catch up on what she's been doing the past 2 years. So prepare to be fascinated. And to everyone who was in that room back in September, you can exhale now. And here's the interview. Oprah, first, let me just say, nothing makes me happier than sitting down with a good read. So when I realized in the preface what an extraordinary book was coming, I was so proud of you. You landed it. The book is tender, it is compelling, it is powerful, it is raw. Michelle Obama, thanks. Oprah, why Becoming? Michelle, we actually had a blooper list of titles that we won't go into here, but Becoming just summed it all up. A question that adults ask kids, I think it's the worst question in the world, is what do you want to be when you grow up? As if growing up is finite, as if you become something and that is all there is. Oprah, you grow up and you are many different things, as you have been many different things. Michelle, I don't know what the next step will be. I tell young people that all the time. You know, all young women probably have some magic number of what age you'll think you'll feel like a grown-up. Generally, when you think your mother will stop telling you what to do. But the truth is, for me, each decade has offered something amazing that I would never have imagined. And if I had stopped looking, I would have missed out on so much. So I'm still becoming, and this is the story of my journey. Hopefully, it will spark conversations, especially among young people, about their journeys. Oprah, there are so many revelations in this book. Was writing about your private life scary? Michelle, actually, no, because there's the thing that I realized. People always ask me, why is it that you're so authentic? How is it that people connect to you? And I think it starts because I like me. I like my story and all the bumps and bruises. I think that's what makes me uniquely me. So I've always been open with my staff, with young people, with my friends. And the other thing, Oprah, I know that whether we like it or not, Barack and I are role models. Oprah, yep. Michelle, I hate when people who are in the public eye, and even seek the public eye, want to step back and say, well, I'm not a role model. I don't want that responsibility. Too late. You are. Young people are looking at you, and I don't want young people to look at me here and think, well, she never had it rough. She never had challenges. She never had fears. Oprah, we're not going to think that after reading this book, we're not going to think that at all. Millions of people have been wondering how you're doing. How's the transition? And I think there's no better example than the toast story. Can you share the toast story? Well, I start the preface right at one of the first weeks after we moved into our new home after the transition. Our new home in Washington, a couple miles away from the White House. It's a beautiful brick home, and it's the first regular house with a door and a doorbell that I've had in 8 years. Oprah, 8 years. Michelle. And so the toast story is about one of the first nights I was alone there. The kids were out. Malia was on her gap year. I think Barack was traveling and I was alone for the first time. As First Lady, you're not alone much. There are people in the house always. There are men standing guard. There is a house full of SWAT people, and you can't open your windows or walk outside without causing a fuss. Oprah, you can't open a window? Michelle, can't open a window. Sasha actually tried one day. Sasha and Malia both, but then we got the call, shut the window. So here I am in my new home, just me and Beau and Sunny, and I do a simple thing. I go downstairs and open the cabinet in my own kitchen, which you don't do in the White House because there's always somebody there going, let me get that. What do you want? What do you need? And I made myself toast. Cheese toast. And then I took my toast and I walked out into my backyard. I sat on the stoop and there were dogs barking in the distance. And I realized Beau and Sunny had never really heard neighbor dogs. They're like, what's that? And I'm like, yep, we're in the real world now, fellas. And it's that quiet moment of me settling into this new life. Having time to think about what had just happened over the last 8 years. Because what I came to realize is that there was absolutely no time to reflect in the White House. We moved at such a breakneck pace from the moment we walked in those doors until the moment we left. It was day in and day out because we, Barack and I, really felt like we had an obligation to get a lot done. We were busy. I would forget on Tuesday what had happened on Monday. I forgot whole countries I visited, literally whole countries. I had a debate with my chief of staff because I was saying, you know, I'd love to visit Prague one day. And Melissa was like, you were there. I was like, no, I wasn't. Wasn't in Prague. Never been to Prague. Oprah, because it's happening at such a breakneck pace. Michelle, she had to show me a picture of me in Prague for the memory to jog. So the toast was the moment that I had time to start thinking about those 8 years and my journey of becoming. Oprah, In reading the book, I can see how every single thing you've done in your life has prepared you for the moments and years ahead. I do believe this. Michelle, that's if you think about it that way. If you view yourself as a serious person in the world, every decision that you make really does build to who you are going to become. Oprah, yes, and I can see that from you in the first grade. You were an achiever with an A++ attitude. Michelle, my mother said I was a little extra. Oprah, getting those little gold stars meant something to you. Michelle, yeah, looking back, I realized there was something about me that understood context. My parents gave us the freedom to have thoughts and ideas very early on. Oprah, they basically let you and Craig figure it out. Michelle, oh gosh, yeah, they did. And what I realized was that achievement mattered, and that kids would get tracked early, and that if you didn't demonstrate ability, particularly as a black kid on the South Side from a working class background, then people were already ready to put you in a box of underachievement. I didn't want people to think I wasn't a hard-working kid. I didn't want them to think I was one of those kids, the bad kids. There are no bad kids. There are bad circumstances. Oprah, you mentioned this phrase that I like so much. I think it should be on a t-shirt or something. Failure, you say, is a feeling long before it becomes an actual result. It's vulnerability that breeds with self-doubt and then is escalated, often deliberately, by fear. Failure is a feeling long before it becomes an actual result. You knew this when? Michelle, oh, first grade. I could see my neighborhood changing around me. We moved there in the 1970s. We lived with my great aunt in a very little apartment over a home she owned. She was a teacher, and my great uncle was a Pullman porter. So they were able to purchase a home in what was then a predominantly white community. Our apartment was so small that what was probably the living room was divided up into three rooms, in quotes. Two were me and my brothers. Each fit a twin bed, and it was just wood paneling that separated us. There was no real wall. We could talk right between us, like, Craig, yep, I'm up, you up? We would throw a sock over the paneling as a game. Oprah, the picture you paint so beautifully in Becoming is that the four of you, you, Craig, and your parents, each was a corner of a square. Your family was the square. Michelle, yes, absolutely. We lived a humble life, but it was a full life. We didn't require much, you know. If you did well, you did well because you wanted to. A reward was maybe pizza night or some ice cream. But the neighborhood was predominantly white when we moved in, and by the time I went to high school, it was predominantly African American. And you started to feel the effects in the community and the school. This notion that kids don't know when they're not being invested in, I'm here to tell you that as a first grader, I felt it. Oprah, you say your parents invested in you. They didn't own their own home. They didn't vacation. Michelle, they invested everything in us. My mom didn't go to the hairdresser. She didn't buy herself new clothes. My father was a shift worker. I could see my parents sacrificing for us. Oprah, did you know at the time it was a sacrifice? Michelle, our parents didn't guilt trip us, but I had eyes, you know. I saw my father going to work in that uniform every day. Oprah, your father drove a black Electra 225. So did my father. Michelle, deuce and a quarter. Oprah, deuce and a quarter. Michelle, we had our little aspirational moments when we'd get in the deuce and a quarter and drive to the nicer neighborhoods and look at the homes. But the deuce and a quarter for my father represented more than just a car, because my father was disabled. He had MS, and he had trouble walking for quite some time. That car was his wings. There was power in that car. I call it a little capsule that we could be in and see the world in a way we normally couldn't. Oprah. A window to the world. You know, I appreciate the way you were able to reveal not just what happened to your family, but what was going on with all families. We often talk about how systemic racism impacts generations, and the way you write about your grandfather, Dandy. I thought this was so beautiful. Quote, gradually he downgraded his hopes, letting go of the idea of college, thinking he'd train to become an electrician instead. But this, too, was quickly thwarted. If you wanted to work as an electrician, or as a steel worker, a carpenter, or a plumber, for that matter, on any of the big job sites in Chicago, you needed a union card. And if you were black, the overwhelming odds were that you weren't going to get one. This particular form of discrimination altered the destinies of generations of African Americans, including many of the men in my family, limiting their income, their opportunity, and eventually their aspirations. End of quote. I don't think I've ever heard a more gut-wrenching truth explained in such simple human terms. Did your parents sit you and Craig down at some point and explain that the world isn't always fair? Michelle, oh yeah, we would have conversations all the time, and my parents helped me to realize that there's something that happens to a person who knows deep inside that they are more than what their opportunities allowed them to be. For Dandy, it bubbled up in him in a discontent that he couldn't shake. That's why my grandparents worked so hard to change our lives. And that's one thing I understood. When I saw my grandparents and heard about their sacrifice, my notion was, oh, little girl, you better get that gold star. They're counting on you. Oprah. It's what Maya Angelou used to say. You've been paid for. Michelle. Absolutely. Oprah, so after high school, you went to Princeton and then Harvard Law School, and then you joined this prestigious law firm in Chicago. Now, this, when I read this, I put three circles around it and two stars. You write, I hated being a lawyer. Michelle, oh God, yeah, sorry, lawyers. Obama, quote, I wanted a life, basically. I wanted to feel whole, end of quote. I wanted to shout that from the mountaintops because I know that so many people are going to read this who are in jobs that they hate, but they feel like they have to continue. How did you come to that, Michelle? It took a lot to be able to say that out loud to myself. In the book, I take you on the journey of who that little striving star-getter became, which is what a lot of hard-driving kids become, a box checker. Get good grades, check. Apply to the best schools, get into Princeton, check. Get there, what's your major? Something that's going to get me good grades so I can get into law school, I guess, check. Get through law school, check. I wasn't a swerver. I wasn't somebody that was going to take risks. I narrowed myself to being this thing I thought I should be. It took losses in my life that made me think, have you ever stopped to think about who you wanted to be? And I realized I had not. I was sitting on the 47th floor of an office building, going over cases and writing memos. Oprah, what I love about it is, it says to every person reading the book, you have the right to change your mind. Michelle, oh gosh, yes. Oprah, were you afraid? Michelle, I was scared to death. You know, my mother didn't comment on the choices that we made. She was live and let live. So one day, she's driving me from the airport after I was doing document production in Washington, D.C., and I was like, I can't do this for the rest of my life. I can't sit in a room and look at documents. I won't get into what that is, but it's deadly, deadly. Document production. So I shared with her in the car, I'm just not happy. I don't feel my passion. And my mother, my uninvolved live and let live mother, said, make the money, worry about being happy later. I was like, gulps. Oh, okay. Because how indulgent that must have felt to my mother. Oprah, yes. Michelle, When she said that, I thought, wow, what? Where did I come from with all my luxury and wanting my passion? The luxury to even be able to decide when she didn't get to go back to work and start finding herself until she got us into high school. So yes, it was hard, and then I met this guy, Barack Obama. He was the opposite of a box checker. He was swerving all over the place. Oprah, you write about meeting him, quote, I'd constructed my existence carefully, tucking and folding every loose and disorderly bit of it, as if building some tight and airless piece of origami. He was like a wind that threatened to unsettle everything, end of quote. At first you didn't like being unsettled. Michelle, oh God, no. Oprah, this I love so much, a moment that cracks me up. Here's another quote. I woke one night to find him staring at the ceiling, his profile lit by the glow of streetlights outside. He looked vaguely troubled, as if he were pondering something deeply personal. Was it our relationship? The loss of his father? I whispered, hey, what are you thinking about over there? He turned to look at me, his smile a little sheepish. Oh, he said, I was just thinking about income inequality. End of quote. Michelle, that's my honey. I mean, here's this guy, and at the time I was a young professional. This is when I was coming into my own right. I had a job that paid more than my parents ever made in their lives. I was rolling with bourgeois class. My friends owned condos. I had a Saab. I don't know what's cool these days, but a Saab back in the day? Oh, yeah. I had a Saab. And the next step was, okay, you get married, you have a lovely home, and on and on and on. Yes, the bigger problems of the world were important, but the more important thing was where you were going in your career. I talk about Barack meeting some of my friends and how they didn't really play out. Because he's this serious sort of income inequality guy, and my friends are like, Oprah, you really let us into the relationship. I mean, down to the proposal and everything. You also write about some major differences between the two of you in the early years of your marriage. You say, quote, I understood it was nothing but good intentions that would lead him to say, I'm on my way or almost home, end of quote. Michelle, oh gosh, yes. Oprah, quote, and for a while I believed these words. I'd give the girls their nightly bath but delay bedtime so that they could wait up to give their dad a hug, end of quote. And then you describe this scene where you'd waited up. He says, quote, I'm on my way, I'm on my way, end of quote. He doesn't come, and then you turn out the lights. I could hear them click off the way you wrote it. Those lights click, you went to bed, you were mad. Michelle, I was mad. When you get married and you have kids, your whole plan, once again, gets upended. Especially if you get married to somebody who has a career that swallows up everything, which is what politics is. Barack Obama taught me how to swerve, but his swerving sort of, you know, I'm flailing in the wind. And now I've got two kids, and I'm trying to hold everything down while he's traveling back and forth from Washington or Springfield. He had this wonderful optimism about time. He thought there was way more of it than there really was, and he would fill it up constantly. He's a plate spinner, plates on sticks, and it's not exciting unless one's about to fall. So there was work we had to do as a couple, counseling we had to do to work through this stuff. Oprah, tell us about counseling. Michelle, well, you go because you think the counselor is going to help you make your case against the other person. Would you tell him about himself? And lo and behold, counseling wasn't that at all. It was about me exploring my sense of happiness. What clicked in me was that I need support and I need some from him, but I needed to figure out how to build my life in a way that works for me. Oprah, The most important thing I think you said was that we live by the paradigms we know. And in Barack's childhood, his father disappeared and his mother came and went. She was devoted to him, but was never really tethered to him. But you grew up in the square, the tight weave of your family. Michelle, his mother was in Indonesia. He was raised by his grandparents. He didn't know his father. And yet, even with this context, he was a solid guy. You realize that there are so many ways to live this life. Oprah, you also write, quote, "When it came down to it, I felt vulnerable when he was away," end of quote. I thought that was kind of amazing to hear a modern woman, a first lady, admit that. Michelle, I feel vulnerable all the time, and I had to learn how to express that to my husband, to tap into those parts of me that missed him, and the sadness that came from that, so that he could understand. He didn't understand distance in the same way. You know, he grew up without his mother in his life for most of his years, and he knew his mother loved him dearly, right? I always thought love was up close. Love is the dinner table. Love is consistency. It is presence. So I had to share my vulnerability and also learn to live differently. It was an important part of my journey of becoming, understanding how to become us. Oprah, what was so valuable to me, and I think will be for everyone else who reads the book, is that nothing really changed. You just changed your perception of what was happening, and that made you happier. Michelle, yeah, and a lot of the reason I share this is because I know that people look to me and Barack as the ideal relationship. I know there's hashtag relationship goals out there, but whoa, people, slow down. Marriage is hard. Oprah, you even say you all argue differently. Michelle, oh, yes. I am like a lit match. It's like poof, and he wants to rationalize everything. So he had to learn how to give me like a couple of minutes or an hour before he should even come in the room when he's made me mad. And he has to understand that he can't convince me out of my anger, that he can't logic me into some other feeling. Oprah, so what was the argument or the conversation that got you to say yes to him running for the presidency? Because you mentioned in the book that every time someone would ask him, he'd say, well, it's a family decision, which was code for, if Michelle says I can, I can. Michelle, imagine having that burden. Could he? Should he? Would he? That happened when he wanted to run for state senate. And then he wanted to run for Congress. Then he was running for the U.S. Senate. I knew that Barack was a decent man, smart as all get out, but politics was ugly and nasty, and I didn't know that my husband's temperament would mesh with that. And I didn't want to see him in that environment. But then on the flip side, you see the world and the challenges that the world is facing. The longer you live and read the paper, you know that the problems are big and complicated. And I thought, well, what person do I know who has the gifts that this man has? The gifts of decency, first and foremost, of empathy, second, of high intellectual ability. This man reads and remembers everything, you know, is articulate, had worked in the community, and really passionately feels like this is my responsibility. How do you say no to that? So I had to take off my wife hat and put on my citizen hat. Oprah, did you feel pressure being the first black family? Michelle, duh, to laughs. Oprah, duh, because we've all been raised with, you've got to work twice as hard to get half as far. Before you came out, I was saying, she's meticulous, not a misstep. Michelle, do you think that was an accident? Oprah, I know it was no accident, but did you feel the pressure of that? Michelle, we felt the pressure from the minute we started to run. First of all, we had to convince our base that a black man could win. It wasn't even winning over Iowa. We first had to win over black people, because black people like my grandparents, they never believed this could happen. They wanted it. They wanted it for us. But their lives had told them no, never. Hillary was the safer bet for them because she was known. Opening hearts up to the hope that America would put down its racism for a black man, I think that hurt too much. It wasn't until Barack won Iowa that people thought, okay, maybe so. Oprah, so my question is, when the weight of the world is on your shoulders and you're the shoulders that he's leaning on, how do you carry that? How do you carry that? Michelle, trying to be the calm in his swerve, doing what I was taught. You know, when the leaves are blowing and the wind is rough, being a steady trunk in his life. Family dinners. That was one of the things I brought into the White House, that strict code of, you got to catch up with us, dude. This is when we're having dinner. Yes, you're president, but you can bring your butt from the Oval Office and sit down and talk to your children. Because children bring solace. They let you turn your sights off the issues of the day and focus on saving the tigers. That was one of Malia's primary goals. She advocated throughout his presidency to make sure the tigers were saved. And hearing about what happened with what school friend, you know, falling into other people's lives, immersing yourself in the reality and the beauty of your children and your family. Plus, on the East Wing side, our motto was, we have to do everything excellently. If we do something, because the First Lady doesn't have to do anything, Oprah laughs, Michelle goes on, we were clear that what we were going to do was going to have impact and was going to be positive. The West Wing had enough going on. We wanted to be the happy side of the house, and we were. You'd have national security advisors coming over to brief me about something. They'd fall into my office, which was beautifully decorated, lots of flowers and apples, and we were always laughing. And they'd sit down for a briefing and wouldn't want to leave. We're done, gentlemen. We don't want to go back, they'd say. Oprah. There's a section in the book that certain news channels were going to have a field day with. You write about Donald Trump stoking the false notion that your husband was not born in this country. You write, quote, Donald Trump, with his loud and reckless innuendos, was putting my family's safety at risk, and for this, I'd never forgive him, end of quote. Why was it important for you to say that at this time? Michelle, because I don't think he knew what he was doing. For him, it was a game. But the threats and security risks that you face as the commander-in-chief, not even within your own country but around the world, are real, and your children are at risk. In order for my children to have a normal life, even though they had security, they were in the world in a way that we weren't. And to think that some crazed person might be ginned up to think my husband was a threat to the country's security, and to know that my children every day had to go to school that was guarded but not secure, that they had to go to soccer games and parties and travel and go to college, to think that this person would not take into account that this was not a game. That's something that I want the country to understand. I want the country to take this in a way I didn't say out loud, but I am saying now. It was reckless, and it put my family in danger, and it wasn't true. And he knew it wasn't true. We had a bullet shot at the Yellow Oval Room during our tenure in the White House. A lunatic came and shot from Constitution Avenue. The bullet hit the upper left corner of a window. I see it to this day, the window of the Truman balcony where my family would sit. That was really the only place we could get outdoor space. Fortunately, nobody was out there at the time. The shooter was caught, but it took months to replace that glass because it's bomb-proof glass. I had to look at that bullet hole as a reminder of what we were living with every day. Oprah, you end the book by talking about what will last, and one of the things that has lasted with you, you say, is the sense of optimism. Oprah, reading from the book, quote, I continue to keep myself connected to a force that's larger and more potent than any one election or leader or news story, and that's optimism. For me, this is a form of faith, an antidote to fear. End of quote. Do you feel that same sense of optimism for our country, for who we are as a nation, becoming? Michelle, yes, we have to feel that optimism for the kids. We're setting the table for them, and we can't hand them crap. We have to hand them hope. Progress isn't made through fear. We're experiencing that right now. Fear is the coward's way of leadership. But kids are born into this world with a sense of hope and optimism, no matter where they're from or how tough their stories are. They think they can be anything because we tell them that. So we have a responsibility to be optimistic and to operate in the world in that way. Oprah, you feel optimistic about our country? Michelle tears up. We have to be. Oprah, aw, good job, good job. Let's move now to the reading room and look at 10 books to pick up now. The first one is Imagine John Yoko by John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Ono personally fashioned this gorgeous volume about the making of the 1971 album, considered among the greatest ever. With interviews, handwritten lyrics, and intimate photos of Lennon and Ono, this open-hearted book documents not just the creative process and the pair's unfolding courtship, but also the idealism that powered their enduring artistry. The second book is Writers, Their Lives and Works, Foreword by James Naughty. Like the family in Sense and Sensibility, Jane Austen once lived in a cottage on a relative's estate. Lu Xun, among China's most influential writers, helped introduce the short story to his country in the early 20th century. This full-color compendium of literary vanguards, 109 mini-bios of scribes from Dante to Arunhati Roy, is replete with nuggets about authors who know, we know, or are encountering for the first time. The third book is Killing Commendator by Haruki Murakami. The latest by a writer who's ever on the Nobel shortlist is a 700-plus page novel with a dreamy undertow. After his wife's affair, a painter retreats from Tokyo to a house in the mountains and connects with a ghostly being visible only to him. A spellbinding parable of art, history, and human loneliness that's also an homage to The Great Gatsby. The fourth book is Ultimate Eats by Lonely Planet Food. Polishing off po' boys in Nola, discovering dim sum in Hong Kong, trolling for tapas in Barcelona. This movable feast ranks, alongside mouth-watering photos, the globe's 500 top food experiences. The world's your oyster, so go slurp a few fresh ones in Tasmania, or just pull up an armchair and savor it all vicariously. The fifth title is The Spirit Almanac by Emma Lowe and Lindsay Kellner. Honoring rituals rooted in religion, astrology, history, and science, this fun and practical modern guide to ancient self-care encourages closer communion with one's inner and outer worlds, whether through breathing exercises, a morning humming practice, or seasonal rites such as smudging, burning an herb to dispel negative energy in your home, to usher in the new year. The sixth title is Brown by Kevin Young. James Brown, Godfather of Soul. John Brown, whose actions paved the way for the Civil War. Church pews that, quote, curve like a bone, end of quote. The renowned poet offers a worship song to all things brown, braiding metaphor and meaning in nimble slant rhymes. And here's a quote. Some black kid who dared talk back like Clement's bat. The seventh title is Trees by Art Wolf. Conservationist and photographer Wolf has assembled an awe-inspiring love letter to the world's arboreal treasures. Imagine a collaboration between Tolkien and Van Gogh, and it might look a lot like this breathtaking compilation of oversized photographs that showcase the grandeur and variety of one of nature's most venerable wonders. The eighth title is Bold and Brave by Kirsten Gillibrand, illustrated by Mira Kalman. The New York Senator's Picture Book for Kids celebrates the suffragists who inspired her own electoral path, including Sojourner Truth and Inez Milholland, the lawyer who led a 1913 march on Washington on horseback while wearing a golden crown. Gillibrand instructs young readers, quote, "Now it's your turn," end of quote. The ninth title, Ruth Bader Ginsburg by Jane Sharon DeHart. From a childhood shadowed by her sister's death to the top of her class at Columbia Law via Harvard, where she shrugged off the nickname bitch, to a seat on the land's highest court. The notorious one is a superhero in black robes wielding her gavel for equality. Historian DeHart gives us the feminist pioneer in all her blazing brilliance in this fulsome biography. And the tenth and final title, Octavia E. Butler's Kindred, by Damian Duffy and John Jennings. Awash in burnished ambers and potent violets, this illustrated adaptation of Butler's 1979 time-traveling classic about a black woman from 70s California suddenly transplanted to the 19th century South amplifies the original's visceral grace. Let's move now to the Feeling Good section of the magazine. And we'll read the article, Who Do You Think You Are? At-home genetic testing can help you understand your biology, but before delving into your DNA, consider the caveats. Ever since the first draft of the human genome was sequenced in 2001, we've heard that examining our DNA data would reveal what makes us tick and what might someday make us sick. Less than 20 years later, for the price of a nice handbag, we're able to use a genetic testing kit to learn more about our past, present, and future than we ever dreamed possible, all from the privacy of home. In 2017, an average of 14 genetic tests were launched daily, according to the technology company Concert Genetics. A recent MIT Technology Review analysis revealed that the number of people who purchased kits more than doubled that year and now exceeds 12 million. That's a lot of people with access to a lot of data. Jeffrey Kahn, PhD, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, says that data is, quote, more raw personal biological information than ever before. Some of that info can be reassuring, some can be overwhelming, and some is simply interesting. The challenge is knowing how to let it affect you, end of quote. If you're interested in becoming better acquainted with yourself, check out this cheat sheet on what you can and can't get from a DNA kit. You can discover where in the world you're from. For less than $100 and a vial of your saliva or a swab of your cheek, companies like Ancestry DNA, 23andMe, and MyHeritage DNA will reveal your ancestral origins. They do this by comparing your DNA to groups that represent regional populations from several hundred years ago, before modern migration, plus more current country populations. In the past, the results matched lineage to vast continental swaths. But over the last 2 years, as companies' databases have expanded and previously unrepresented groups have been included, the tests have been increasingly able to offer more specific geographic information. For example, 23andMe used to tell customers they simply had, say, sub-Saharan African ancestry. Now it can sometimes reveal if they're Sudanese or Nigerian. and Ancestry DNA may be able to tell those with Irish roots whether they're from County Kerry or County Cork. You can't determine your clan, class, or tribe. Scott Hadley, a 23andMe spokesperson, says, quote, "We aren't able to satisfy the curiosity of Scandinavians who wonder whether they're related to Vikings," end of quote. And while the tests may tell you that you're part Native American, they can't link you to specific tribes, few of which have shared their DNA for research purposes. You can find out whether you have certain mutations that increase your risk of cancer. Last spring, 23andMe made headlines after winning FDA approval to expand its $199 consumer test to detect certain mutations in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that increase the risk of breast, ovarian, and prostate cancer. This test, which can be taken without a doctor's authorization, identifies the three most common mutations in people of European Jewish descent, says Lisa Madlinsky, director of the Family Center Genetics Program at UC San Diego Health. Color Genomics offers a $99 test that looks at 30 genes associated with 8 hereditary cancers. The test must be ordered by a physician, but the company can connect you with one for free. Madalinsky says, quote, "While everyone has some risk of getting cancer, these tests identify people who have a much higher than average risk, who might benefit from more frequent screenings that start at a younger age," end of quote. You can't calculate your odds of getting cancer. Even with a BRCA mutation, your individual risk of getting breast cancer varies according to the kind of mutation you have, your age, and your family and medical history. A positive result still needs to be confirmed in a medical lab, and a negative result doesn't mean you're in the clear. There are thousands of BRCA mutations not identified by these tests. People with a family history of breast cancer should talk with their doctor about more comprehensive testing in consultation with a genetic counselor. You can stumble across family members you never knew you had. You may have idly fantasized about having a secret sibling, but you've probably never considered the emotional repercussions of discovering a real-life surprise sister or parent. Yet when genetic testing companies compare clients' info, they may turn up relatives who share the same DNA. The result is a brave new world of paternity scandals, mamma mia, and pregnancies that were supposed to remain hush-hush. In fact, the private Facebook group DNA NPE Friends, NPE stands for Not Parent Expected, now has more than 3,000 members, many of them shocked genetic test users. While the news is sometimes welcome, Timothy Caulfield, research director of the University of Alberta's Health Law Institute, advises would-be testers to think about how they'd react to finding out that dad isn't their biological father or that they have a mystery big brother. You can't likely connect with relatives past your fifth cousins. On average, you share 0.05% of your DNA with your fifth cousins, with whom you also share great-great-great-great grandparents. So even if you're sure you're somehow related to Rihanna or Tina Fey, family rumor, it's hard to correctly identify very distant relatives and prove it. You can help assess your risk for certain cardiovascular conditions. Geneticists have identified hundreds of DNA markers that influence your risk for developing heart disease. And now there are panels that test for several of these key genes at once. The medical testing lab, Invitae, offers a doctor-ordered $250 cardiovascular test that can detect DNA mutations associated with cardiomyopathy, a condition that weakens heart muscles and can lead to heart failure. Robert Nussbaum, MD, Invitae's chief medical officer, says, quote, If you know you have it, then you could try to avoid heavy exercise and get frequent checkups, end of quote. The panel also detects genes for arrhythmias, which can cause fatal abnormal heartbeats and conditions that rupture blood vessels. One of the most significant advances is increased testing for hypercholesterolemia, FH, which can involve dangerously high levels of bad, that is LDL, cholesterol from a young age. Daniel Rader, MD, who specializes in cardiovascular genetics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, says, quote, an estimated 90% of people are unaware they have this, end of quote. Yet people with FH have up to 20 times the risk of heart disease, which can lead to heart attacks and strokes. You can't discover that you'll have a heart attack by age 50. Rader says, quote, these tests show only the probability of having a heart attack compared with the average person, end of quote. Still, that info can inspire you to make key lifestyle changes to consider whether cholesterol-lowering medication is right for you. You can find out if you're at increased risk for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. A number of tests now include the genetic variant APOE4, which is linked to an increased risk for Alzheimer's. People with one copy, that's 22% of the population, have three times the risk of developing the disease by age 85. According to Harvard geneticist Robert C. Green, MD, the 2% of people who have two copies are 15 times more likely. As for Parkinson's, a small percentage of cases have a genetic basis. People of Ashkenazi Jewish or North African descent with a particular genetic variant have about a 25% increased risk of developing the disease. Note, 23andMe lets you decide whether you'd rather not know if you have these variants. You can't know for sure that you'll get a life-changing disease. Experts say genetic variants aren't the sole predictors of risk. The chances and timing of developing Alzheimer's or Parkinson's may be affected by other genes or lifestyle factors such as diet and exercise. At the same time, researchers continually discover new genes. So testing negative for these variants doesn't mean you're free from all risk. Learning about your genetics can be powerful, but they're only one factor in determining your fate. The rest is up to you. Still in Feeling Good, we have an article here on Instant Pot versus Slow Cooker. Which effort-saving appliance could help you eat better? If you're resolving to make more nutritious meals at home in 2019, good news. These two super convenient devices can speed and simplify cooking. We asked experts to highlight their best features so you can figure out which is right for you. So here are the pros of electric pressure cooker versus slow cooker. The electric pressure cooker, this appliance, Instant Pot, is the best known brand, uses high temperature steam to cook food quickly. Some models can also act like a rice cooker, yogurt maker, cake maker. Desserts can be part of a healthy eating plan too. Egg cooker, saute pan, steamer, warmer, sterilizer, and slow cooker. The pros of the slow cooker. Here, an electric heating element slowly warms a stoneware pot to cook your food. It's a user-friendly, virtually foolproof, set-it-and-forget-it device. You can simply throw in your ingredients, flip a switch, and walk away, and stay away for hours. The cons of an electric pressure cooker. Mastering the cooking functions takes practice. For example, slow cooker recipes often require tweaks to temperature and liquid level and still may not come out as expected. No method is truly instant. Even in pressure cooker mode, the device may need 20 minutes to build up pressure and another 10 to release it. The cons of the slow cooker. Slower than slow. It can't rescue you from your 5 p.m. what's for dinner dilemma. And consistent, gentle heat over such a long period can leave some food bland and mushy or rubbery. The electric pressure cooker is best for easy-to-peel hard-boiled eggs, big batches of hearty whole grains in less time than it takes to simmer them on the stove, speedy dried beans, they're not as salty as canned, but usually need to be soaked for 12 hours before cooking unless you have a pressure cooker. It's good for homemade yogurt, cheaper and less sugary than store-bought. The slow cooker is best for braised meat as well as any hearty vegetable that can stand up to heat, potatoes, carrots, eggplant, fennel. Caramelize cherry tomatoes to top toast or grain bowls. Protein-rich bean and lentil dishes like dal. Grain dishes such as farro risotto that usually require monitoring. And here are tips for the electric pressure cooker. Don't wing it. Read the manual, follow the instructions, and do the recommended water test to get a feel for your product. Maybe even watch a few YouTube videos. Then use the suggested timetables instead of guesstimating cooking durations. And heed the warnings. The steam released during the pressure cooking is hot. Tips for the slow cooker. Go light on liquid, especially with vegetables, which tend to have a high water content. Go heavy on seasonings and spicings. Because thin pieces of meat are easy to overcook, opt for thicker, fattier cuts of pork or beef, as well as chicken thighs over breasts. To ensure even cooking temps, your pot should be 2/3 to 3/4 full. Bottom line, if you find time to prep in the morning, the slow cooker can have a meal ready for you when you get home. If you have 45 minutes to an hour in the evening and more ambitious or gourmet plans, pressure cooking is the way to go. Dinner done. And finally, at least 1% of American adults suffer from seasonal affective disorder, SAD, a type of depression that comes and goes this time of year. And here are two items to help out. Dawn simulating alarm clocks, which start glowing 30 minutes before you need to wake up, $200 at Philips.com. And circadian rhythm lamps to sync your body with the time of day. You need to be exposed to brighter bluish light in the morning and dimmer yellow light in the evening. $150 for GE's SOL Soul. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.